Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Thomas v. Cook County. Mr. Creighton? Good morning.
I represent Cook County this morning. I would like to, in my opening argument with the court this morning, address the following issues. First of all, I would like to address the liability against Cook County for $4,150,000 based on three Monell claims, the three Monell claims being first the issues raised by the Supreme Court case of Los Angeles versus Heller, secondly the issue of the liability found in this case based upon the funding of the correctional officers by the county to the sheriff, and thirdly the finding of Monell liability in this case for failure to repair a video monitor. After I address the Monell issues, I would like to then address the prejudicial hearsay that was admitted into evidence in this trial.
Mr. Creighton, before you start, I had a question about these three claims that you just described, because my question is this. Are these three different ways in which the plaintiffs were proving that Cook County violated the decedent's rights? And if so, does it matter whether we find that all three of them are supported, or would it be enough for one or two? Or are these really, in your view, three absolutely distinct and separate theories, each of which needs to be supported?
There are three distinct theories that need to be supported, in my view, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because the evidence would be individual to each of those theories. They're independent evidence and independent legal questions as to each of those theories.
Well, I understand that. But what I'm saying is, I mean, at the end of the day, what the plaintiff is saying is that there's a Monell claim against Cook County. In other words, that Cook County itself had policies and practices that violated Mr. Smith's constitutional rights. And if there was a violation of rights, then I'm not sure why compartmentalizing the evidence that shows that is the appropriate perspective.
Well, for example, under the Los Angeles versus Heller argument, there is a requirement that we have an actor that found was the person who actually acted that caused the constitutional violation, and there is none in regards to medical care, denial of medical care in this case. And if you're looking at the broad picture and the broad evidence in their case, there isn't any evidence that there was a policy on a county level to just simply not provide medical care at the jail. We have a 24-hour emergency room on site. There are dispensaries on every...
I understand that. I mean, I guess if we want to get to the more specifics, it's possible you would agree, is it not, that there be a de facto policy that the idea of a policy under Monell is not limited to things that are written down in a book or on a piece of paper.
Correct.
Okay, so the question then is, could a rational jury have concluded that there was a de facto policy of failing to act on medical requests of detainees?
I don't believe so in this case, Your Honor. If the evidence had been that gets into the hearsay arguments that were in this case as to impermissible hearsay that the jury was permitted to hear from the very first witnesses in the case in regards to imputed knowledge of let me go back to the hearsay statements.
Well, let's not go to the hearsay yet, because I think that the perspective that we have to take, given that there's been a jury verdict, is the one that I just articulated, that was there evidence from which a rational jury could conclude that there was actually a systematic failure on the part of Cook County to have an adequate system for acting on medical requests. And such a finding wouldn't preclude the idea that on some sort of hit-or-miss basis, some people managed to make it over to CERMAC. We know that that's true. One of the witnesses, Mr. Matthias was getting his methadone treatments and so on. But if there was a failure of a system, then that would be something the jury would infer from whatever evidence was there.
I don't think a rational jury could have reached that decision in this case. And I would point to the evidence in regards to the Los Angeles versus Heller issue, where there were CMTs or the paramedics on the tiers each day during that week, visiting the tiers, collecting medical request slips. All of the CMTs were identified in this case through their through the assignment sheets. All of them were deposed by the plaintiff prior to trial in this case. Five of them were dismissed prior to trial. The one remaining CMT was found not guilty.
And that's evidence from which a jury might have found in your favor. I don't think this wasn't a jury case at all. But what about, for example, the testimony of the various inmates? They were trying to make requests for Smith. What about the testimony of Mr. Fradick, who was the director of CIRMAC, who was saying he was aware that the medical request forms weren't being picked up? What about the other evidence in the record that suggests that there was a failure to follow up systematically?
In regards to the grievance, the grievance goes the other way. There was a system in place to have grievances addressed, which they were in regards to Exhibit 40, which...
There was evidence that they were... Actually, Exhibit 40 looks funny. The thing that we got yesterday, did you look at that?
Yes. I don't know what you got yesterday. I know what I had given.
It looks like, I don't know where I put it, it looks like somebody scratched out, scratched out the date down at the bottom of the page.
Well, it's within that, there is a date at the top that's legible, and that would be the date that I was going by, and it's in that same time period.
In any event, what I'm trying to get you to focus on is the evidence that you don't like, you know, that the evidence that would have allowed the jury to find a systematic failure to attend a medical request.
There still would be a requirement of a finding of fault against an actor on behalf of the county, and there was not in this case by the jury.
I'm not sure that I agree with your interpretation of these earlier cases. There certainly are some times when you have a fairly simple case where there's, say, a police officer and a municipality or a county or some governmental body, and if the police officer is found to be free of responsibility, then automatically you can't find it. But this isn't that kind of case. This isn't A didn't do it, B didn't do it. This is a case where there's an allegation of an entire system of many people over many years, and they don't all necessarily have to have been named as defendants.
If we're talking about 1 week in April of 2004, Your Honor.
I don't think that's what the plaintiffs are talking about in their Monell claim. They're talking about a policy that was wrong.
Well, it would be the policy that affected Mr. Smith during that, if there was a policy that an unconstitutional policy, it would be the policy for that affected Mr. Smith during that 1 week.
That's when the effects happened, but their
right.
Allegation, I believe, is that this was just a policy of Cook County.
Right. And
not just that week. They didn't make it up at the beginning of the week and abandon it at the end.
Right.
Of the week.
But the policy shows. The policy, as testified to by Dr. Rava, the medical director, and as admitted in evidence this case, was to provide medical care to each inmate from the time of incarceration until the time of discharge.
That was the written policy
of the medical director.
And they are arguing that there was a de facto policy of not doing that.
But there were paramedics on that tier every day that week, which was one of the policies the jury found that was being violated, picking up slips on no policy in effect to guarantee or affirm picking up the slips, yet the evidence is that there were CMTs on that tier every single day that week. And in fact, Ms. Westbrook testified, and they're in evidence, that she had picked up 36 slips on one day and 8 slips on another day on a healthy tier.
So then what are we to do with all this evidence that the system was broken?
They would
just ignore it? You know, because it's not, you got Darius Parker, the cleanup worker. You have this grievance that was filed by 52 other Division 5 detainees who filed a written grievance, and they were talking about the week before the Smith situation. So that evidence.
The evidence.
How should we view that?
The evidence of the grievance shows that, in fact, if there are problems, they're addressed. And in regards to that grievance, the specific problem or the issue that the detainees were asking for was cold medication, which, in fact, is not given out on a tier to every single person who requests it on a tier because they actually grind it up and use it as a stimulant. They're only treated if they're ill. And the grievance was addressed and responded to, and there is a grievance procedure in effect in the jail. And if there's a grievance procedure, that certainly doesn't indicate that there's a policy to ignore complaints by detainees. In regards to whether what the jury could have believed or not, in regards to the policy issues in this case, the evidence shows that the night before Mr. Smith died, we have, with the limitations of the HIPAA order that was entered by Judge Castile, we have 23 inmates from various parts of the jail coming in and being treated in the emergency room, including two from Mr. Smith's tier, from Tier M1. So where is the evidence of a policy at that point to deny medical care when detainees are being treated on a 24-hour basis 7 days a week? I'd just like to follow up in regards to the on the Monell issue. In regards to your question, Your Honor, we did identify everybody, the CMTs in this case. They were all named and they were all available, so Heller should apply. And Judge Castile, in the memorandum of opinion, acknowledged that there were no liability found against any individual on behalf of the county, and then relied upon the fact that the sheriffs were found liable in this case in violation of Moy and the earlier opinion in this court of I see I'm in my
Let me just ask you, since you were referring to the CMTs, as I understand it, a number of CMTs didn't even have keys to the lock boxes and couldn't get the forms out, or even if they could have, there weren't guards in the area, as I understand some of the testimony, to let them into the lockbox.
The testimony was in regarding to that. Miss Westbrook did have a key, and in regards to the two temporary or the who called in because of sick on the 29th, they had keys available through the supervisor, and that was the testimony in the case. Nobody's testified in this case that they didn't get into the lockbox or they didn't get on the tier during those weeks. Or during that one specific week. I mean, Ms. Westbrook testified she was on the tiers, and Mr. West testified in regards to the 29th she was on the tiers. Mr. Patton testified he was on the tiers that week. The testimony of the CM of the paramedics says they were on the tier. I'd like to briefly address the liability based upon the funding issue. Just very briefly, there's never been a case that's upheld funding against the county. A county or a municipality based on funding and understaffing of guards. There was $133 million allocated for 2,700-plus officers in 2004, and there shouldn't be a basis of Monell liability. In regards to the video monitor, there's no causation or constitutional requirement of repair, and there's no causation in this case. I know I'm in my rebuttal time, but I just want to briefly get to the hearsay issue. The first witness in this case was the investigator who, for the Sheriff's Department, who was allowed to testify to hearsay statements of Dr. Anna Galate, which clearly were not admissible over objection.
My broad question about your hearsay arguments is whether, even if you're right, and some of this was inadmissible hearsay, and some of it may have been, where is the harm? Because to take Dr. Angelate, for example, what Dr. Angelate says, or Rayer says that Dr. Angelate says, He'd heard that Smith had been complaining of sickness. Well, we have lots of other evidence in the record from inmates who say Smith was complaining of sickness. So we already have that underlying evidence in the record. The jury isn't hearing anything they haven't already heard. Why is this harmful?
Here's why it was harmful, Your Honor. First of all, this was the very first witness, and that hearsay came in through the sheriff's investigator, which gave it more credibility than it would have had otherwise. Secondly, Dr. Ana Galate is a physician at CIRMAC, so the hearsay that's attributable to him has more credence than it would otherwise. And when the jury went back to deliberate, the first thing they requested for was Rahear's report.
But then, of course, the district judge also thinks that this is a way of seeing this, I guess, gets to at least one of the possible layers of hearsay here. Dr. Angelate is simply reporting as a professional why he's treating this man. He's explaining his action as opposed to, you know, whether inmate Smith had been complaining or not, it doesn't really matter. What's Dr. Angelate doing with that?
Yeah, but it wasn't used that way throughout the trial. It was used as substantive argument all the way through, including closing argument.
But
that
there
in
you
fact,
have the cumulative point that I'm
right.
concerned with.
It was used all the way through, including closing argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Creighton. Mr. Keller.
May it please the Court. Christopher Keller on behalf of the Cook County Sheriff and Officers Fasundo, Toomey, and Sanchez. Your Honors, we have three issues in our brief, and we think they all merit your attention. But the utterly decisive point, and the one we would like to address first, is this. Should an evidentiary axiom be discarded because a witness did not want to appear in court? If refusal to cooperate becomes a ground for excusing live testimony, trial by deposition will become the norm. There are a number of reasons why we prevail. First, the reason Carlos Matias did not want to appear, he simply did not want to testify in court.
Could I interrupt you, though, Mr. Kelleher, because we have a finding of fact by the district court that the two subpoenas and the efforts to procure the attendance of Mr. Matias in court represented reasonable diligence on the part of the plaintiffs, and there was no bad faith on the plaintiff's side that lay behind the failure to get Mr. Matias into the court. So normally we defer to findings of fact like that. The rules themselves, Rule 32, recognizes that if you can't procure the attendance of a witness by subpoena, which seems to be the case, they were trying subpoenas and it wasn't working, the district court is entitled to authorize the use of the deposition.
Judge Wood, abuse of discretion is a high standard, but it's not an insurmountable one. And there are a few reasons.
So you agree, then, that we're on an abuse of discretion?
I do, Your Honor. And admittedly, it is a high standard, but as I said, not an insurmountable one. And
so where's the evidence of failure to use diligence? Do you think the sheriff should have gone out and looked for Mr. Matias?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Matias was the plaintiff's witness. The onus was on the plaintiff to secure his presence.
And they say they exercised great effort to try it and were keeping the district court apprised. I mean, you say in your brief, well, we knew he was in Chicago, but as I probably don't need to remind you, that's really not a very limiting fact. I mean, Chicago is a really big city, and there are all kinds of places that you could be if you know somebody's in Chicago.
Mr. Keller, why don't you give us the timeline on this issue? As I understand it, the 2 days before his testimony, there's a representation he will appear.
Correct.
What occurs at that? Is it just a representation, everyone accepts it, and there's no further dialogue with the court or counsel?
Your Honor, December 5th, that's the day. It's not clear in the record because it occurs essentially off the record. You see Judge Castillo say it's been brought to my attention that he will be made available December 7th. And Judge Flom, that's the critical point in this case. On December 5th, Carlos Matias, per plaintiff's representations, was available. And that representation essentially lulled the court and the appellants into a sense of false complacency.
What then occurs? 2 days later, the trial commences?
The trial commenced through that period, December 5th, December 6th, and then December 7th, the morning Mr. Matias is to appear, and also the day that plaintiff's case is wrapped up.
All right. What representation is made then about Mr. Matias by plaintiff's counsel?
Nothing. They simply say he's not here.
Does the court make an inquiry about what diligence has been inquired of?
None, Your Honor.
What is the position of the defendants at that point?
Well, Judge Baum, the district court brought it out while the jury was paneled, while it was in the box, and we had made our objections throughout. I think the record's clear. And simply there was no objection made at that point, simply because the jury
was... To the deposition or to no further efforts being made by either the court or counsel?
Both. Mr. Gallagher had made it clear that he believed Mr. Matias was available, and the district court on November 29th or December 5th says, I reject that 100% and cuts off any further inquiry. So there was a record made. The objections were preserved.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to get what kind of focus was then made by anyone on the diligence question. Was there a suggestion of continuing the trial for a day or two? What was Matias represented to be the next witness?
Yes, Your Honor. He was set for December 7th.
And counsel steps up and says he's unavailable.
On December 7th, yes.
Under the jury?
Yes. I believe it was as the jury was being brought in. And at that point, Judge Castillo cut off any... He did not let appellant's counsel discuss the issue further.
So the trial judge accepted at that point he makes a finding of unavailability. Is that what you're suggesting?
He did, Your Honor.
There's no further discourse on that.
No, there was not, Your Honor. There had been virtually, I believe, four or five separate occasions, four or five separate days where this issue was discussed, and appellant's counsel objected vehemently to this scenario.
Interesting thing is you're implying then, unlike what I'm understanding from what you're saying to Judge Flom, that there was some reason to think 2 days before that maybe Matias wouldn't show up. If you've had all these conversations, when did that possibility first come about?
It came up from the first day of trial that Mr. Matias was giving plaintiff's counsel grief in terms of appearing.
Was there any suggestion made that a warrant should be issued for his arrest or anything like that? Was there any discussion about what? Did the defendant suggest, well, perhaps, you know, we have doubts about whether he's going to show up, you should issue an arrest warrant to be certain?
That was brought up, but again, it was prompt. This was all prompted by the district court.
I'm saying that was brought up, but that was not pursued. You're saying that this was discussed, right? It sounds like every day.
Yes.
Okay. So was there some discussion that, you know, we have real serious doubts about whether he's going to appear, could the court issue an arrest warrant?
Yes, that was brought up.
And the court rejected that?
The court suggested it, and on December 5th, plaintiff's counsel said there's no need for a bench warrant because he's going to be here. So those are two critical days, December 5th, December 6th, where no one did anything, including the district court, including appellant's counsel, didn't pursue it.
And the plaintiff's case was wrapping up on that final day, and at what point was it clear that he wasn't going to show up? Was this close to a break? Was this close to the lunch hour?
Yes.
So I understand that the court didn't entertain any discussion while the jury was in the box, but once the recess came, was there a request then made by you to get an arrest warrant out for him?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
Was that issue raised again to the court?
It was not.
Outside the presence of the jury?
It was not, Your Honor. The district court had already made up its mind. And the court's questions, I think, they go to the point that plaintiff's counsel essentially presented the district court with a fait accompli on the morning of December 7th. And again, those two critical days, reasonable diligence would suggest that plaintiff's counsel, knowing that there are issues with Mr. Matias, would have asked the court for a bench warrant. And they never did that.
Mr. Keller, that the district court was amenable to an arrest warrant a couple days before?
It was, Your Honor. It was.
It was just put off because of your position being representations by plaintiff's counsel that he would be there.
Those are in the record, Your Honor. On December 5th, plaintiff's counsel says, there's no problem, everything's copacetic, he will be here December 7th. And obviously that was not the case.
So there was no request for a continuance or anything. When the 7th came, it was clear he wasn't going to be there. court didn't entertain anything at that moment in front of the jury. Was there a request when you had the opportunity to ask for a recess or to kick it over a day so a warrant could be issued?
No, Your Honor.
No continuance request?
No, Your Honor. The district court had made up its mind, and as district court judges are wont to do, they run a very tight ship, and understandably so. And at that point, it was already settled.
When did the discussion about the deposition occur? I mean, when did it, at that point, is that when it first gets rid
of? No, Your Honor. Those discussions had gone on from virtually day one of the trial.
Now, is that because there's been this unease about this witness showing?
Yes, on plaintiff's part. Plaintiff knew from day one that there were issues with Mr. Matias's appearance and his amenableness to appear. Now, Your Honors, admitting this deposition, it was not a mundane mistake. It was a major one.
And let me ask you this. When did the court review the deposition when it became clear that he wasn't going to appear? When was the deposition reviewed in terms of what should be admitted or not? Because I know the court struck some of the testimony or didn't allow some of it to go in.
Yes, Your Honor. It was the December 6th, I believe, and December 7th. December 6th, the district court does say, I would like both counsel to review it in case he doesn't appear. So even at that point.
So then we have some indication on the 6th that he may not appear. The court is reviewing it.
Right. Even the district court at that point thought that that was a possibility. And I think, once again, that's another reason why reasonable diligence would suggest that you would pursue it further and say, Your Honor, you know, we're still not certain he's going to be here. Can we have a bench warrant?
Well, was that suggested on the 6th when the court was reviewing a deposition for admissibility and this issue was raised?
It was not. It was on the 5th. That was brought up on the 5th.
But then when he takes the further step on the 6th to look at the deposition to examine it, clearly he thinks that he's probably not going to show up. Otherwise, why bother with dealing with the testimony? But that was not discussed, the warrant.
No, it was not, Your Honor. So, again, I see my time is up, but I would simply point out that this was not reasonable diligence, and the admission of this deposition seriously impacted the trial because it denied the jury the ability to assess Mr. Matias's demeanor and credibility. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions, thank you.
If I understand, Ms. Keller, you're going to address rebuttal, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Alexander?
If it please the court, Dan Alexander from Arleta Thomas, the plaintiff appellee. Your Honors, let me jump right in. Document 450 in the docket for the trial court is plaintiff's oral motion for a rule to show cause as to Carlos Matias is granted. This is on December 5th. In their reply brief, they'd said that we never made a motion for rule to show cause. There was never one granted. Therefore, we could not have served him with the order. That is obviously quite wrong. Document 450 says Carlos Matias is ordered to appear in open court on 12/5/2007 at 9:30 and testify. If he fails, the court will issue a warrant for his arrest. So on the 5th, we did in fact make a motion for rule to show cause. The motion was granted. Then we served Mr. Matias with the motion, and we were hoping that that would get his appearance on the 7th. Also in the record, we hired a private investigator.
On the 5th, you had him located.
I believe our investigator knew how to find him. He kind of came and went, basically. He stayed at his girlfriend sometimes. But he did find him and serve him with Judge Castillo's order saying, you got to appear on the 7th or you're going to be held in contempt. And that's all in the record, even though they deny it in their reply brief, Your Honors. So I think it's important to understand, we knew from the very beginning this witness was a trouble getting him in. He was very resistant about testifying, and we apprised everyone of that on the first day of testimony in this case. The first day of testimony, we stood up and said, hey, we got a problem with Matias. And we tried to work it out together. We made a lot of phone calls. We spent money on an investigator. We served him, as the record reflects, with two subpoenas. We made the rule to show cause order. We served him with the warrant. We tried to get our investigator to bring him in on the 7th, and Matias just refused to come.
Let me ask you this. We're toward the end of the trial here, aren't we? A plaintiff's case.
It started at the beginning of the trial and went all the way through our case.
I didn't mean the problem, Mr. Alexander. I mean the presentation or the attempted presentation of Mr. Matias.
Yes, sir. It was. I don't believe the exact name, but it was towards the end of the plaintiff's case.
I don't want to get into strategy because it's not appropriate. But I have some wonder. Is there anybody more critical than Mr. Matias?
Your Honor,
of the inmate witnesses.
Your Honor, actually, Mr. Matthias basically repeated what several other witnesses said.
No. He adds a little bit more, don't you think?
A little bit more. What he brings, Your Honor, that wasn't cumulative of the other witnesses maybe is that he was the actual cellmate of Norman Smith. But we have two other cellmates of Norman Smith. They came in later in the week.
But isn't Matthias the one who makes the attempt to inform authorities?
Actually, Your Honor, he makes attempts, but also tier mates Mitchell, York, Robatus, Haynes, and Robinson all testified. This is 5 other tier mates testified about their efforts to get medical attention for the decedent, about either written or verbal to the guards, to the nurses, or both. So there were 5 other tier mates that testified to very similar things that Matthias testified.
Why do we need the deposition? I mean, he'd be the, 6th or 7th under your count?
I mean, whether we need it or not, again, that probably gets the strategy. We probably didn't need it, Your Honor, because...
My focus here, I'm sure it's evident. I have some concern about where he ranks in the critical nature of things. And I think he provides, it seems to me, pretty powerful testimony.
Well,
you say it's only duplicative. There's nothing standalone about his testimony. Then of course, I'll review that. But I just wonder if that's the case, whether he stands apart as to weight and as to substance of day by day is what I'm saying, Mr. Alexander.
I don't think it would be fair to say that he doesn't bring anything extra. I think he was a strong witness, although there were 5 other tier mates who testified. But I would remind the court that in the Rascon case, the court specifically found that that witness was essential to the plaintiff, and yet they did not overrule the district court's discretionary call that diligence had been made. And in Rascon, as the court, I'm sure the court's aware, the witness wasn't even subpoenaed. Here we've got 2 subpoenas and all these other efforts, the rule to show cause and everything else. Rascon, the witness wasn't even subpoenaed. This court said...
Well, we didn't have a location for the witness in Rascon. Apparently we have some location here if we were able to serve the rule.
An occasional location. Right. But I'm simply pointing out that the Rascon witness was essential, whereas here, Matthias, you could argue that he brought a little something extra, but there were these other 5 witnesses. And the district court talked about this at length in his opinion, how these other witnesses basically testified to the same thing that that Mr. Matthias did.
Now, when you say tier mates, though, which other cellmates? Mr. Mitchell, was he a cellmate?
By tier mates, I mean they were on the M1 tier.
Right, I'm saying that Matthias is inside the cell cleaning up after
correct.
Mr. Smith, and which is a little more vivid, at least.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. He was there more time and more testimony. That's why we made all these efforts to get him in. I mean, we thought he was an important witness, and we certainly made a lot of efforts to try and get Mr. Matthias in, and we kept the court.
So you were just surprised, or you're on the 7th when you thought you were going to have him and he wasn't there?
Well, we had hoped that serving him with this order and would bring about the desired effect, but it was really just a hope because having dealt with Mr. Matthias, he's a kind of a unique individual would be. If you read his testimony, then you might get a feel for it. And I was a little worried personally that if you serve him with this order, threatening him with arrest, it might have the opposite effect on him because of the way he thinks.
You had a deposition in hand, didn't you?
Pardon me, sir?
But you had a deposition in hand. I mean, he might have come a little under heavy whip and not as friendly as one would hope, from the plaintiff's standpoint, but he's kind of locked in if you get him into court, isn't he?
Right. Well, exactly. That's why we wanted him to testify, Your Honor. And we made all these efforts to get him in to testify.
So the question is, under Rule 32, do you, as the party who wants Mr. Matthias' testimony, have an obligation to escalate matters all the way up to the arrest warrant level? Or does Rule 32 leave more discretion in the hands of the district court?
I would certainly argue, Your Honor, that it is discretionary. There's no case law been cited, and I'm not aware of any that has that requirement built in to the rule. And I think it's a matter for discretion, for the court's discretion. I mean, Judge Castillo is a very experienced judge, and we kept him apprised all along, and he knew what was going on. I mean, And, you know, he did what he thought he could do, and in the end he realized there's nothing we could do to get this guy in. He was just going to ignore the
problem. But Judge Castile does have some discussion on the 6th about this whole arrest warrant business and talks about issuing an arrest warrant.
I believe that's true, Your Honor. I think we cite the pages in
right.
Right.
And so, I mean, he recognized what he could have done, and certainly you knew what you could have requested.
Well, on the 6th, if I'm not mistaken, and I believe the record supports this, on the 6th, I think when we served, when we had our investigator serve Matthias with the rule to show cause order and said he had to appear on the 7th, I believe he told our investigator he would show up. So I think that's what we told the judge on the 6th. Hey, you know, he says he's going to come. You know, we've got our fingers crossed. He says he's going to come. And then we tried to get our investigator to actually, you know, snatch him and bring him in. But even that didn't. And he wasn't there on the 7th when our investigator went to find him. He wasn't at his girlfriend's and ignored the order and did what.
So you sent your investigator out that morning of the 7th, to pick him up? Is that what you're saying? And you represented that to the court?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I don't want to argue anything that's not in the record, but I believe we do cite the pages where it came up in our transcript, and I believe that's exactly what we did. And hopefully it's reflected in the record there, Your Honor. I didn't bring those pages with me, though. So, unless the court has more questions on that point, I can move to another. I want to talk about the Monell situation. The Heller case, which, as the court knows, is per curiam. It wasn't even briefed. And it does not apply. The Owen case makes it perfectly clear that you can bring a Monell claim for, quote, interactive behavior of several government officials. And if you look at the Owen case, I realize, excuse me, Your Honors, it's a 1980 case. It's still good law. It's still cited. And if you look at the Owen case, it's practically something out of a law and economics textbook here. It talks about how, hey, when there's government wrongdoing, we should put the onus, we should put the cost of the wrongdoing on the people who did it, on the government. And if it's a systemic problem like we have here, that you can file a Monell claim. You don't have to have an individual liability.
I have a question for you about this Monell claim, though. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm going to digress back to the investigator to say that in footnote 10 of the district court's opinion, it looks to me as though the record shows that your investigator transported Matthias on December 7, but that he ultimately refused to attend court, although the court was not aware of this at the time, he says. But anyway, my question for the Monell claim is this. We have this complicated relationship in Illinois between a county and a sheriff, and there have been all kinds of cases at both the state level trying to outline what that is and on the federal level. So for purposes of your Monell claim, you had to name the county because they control the budget. We've said that the county is an indispensable party. Are they joint venturers? Is just the sheriff in this sense, are the sheriff's actions attributable to the county, or are they each equally responsible for different things? How do you see the relative roles breaking down?
Your Honor, the way we view it is that there's joint and several liability here. These are joint tortfeasors. So,
so they're sort of like joint venturers. It's not like the sheriff works for the county or the county works for the sheriff.
Exactly. We're not using respondeat superior. We're not saying one is responsible for the other's conduct. We're saying these are joint tortfeasors, and the jury found them jointly and severally liable for these three systemic violations which caused the death of Norman Smith. So that's exactly what we're saying, Your Honor.
What should we do? Just hypothetically, I'm still trying to figure out the relation among these three theories. Suppose we thought, hypothetically, that the failure to fix the broken video monitors was not sufficiently linked up to Mr. Smith's death, and so that was not there, but that there was plenty of evidence to support numbers 1 and 2, the system and the understaffing. Does that require a remand, or is the video monitor just kind of extra color to the finding of the violation?
Well, Your Honor, if the court looks at the verdict form, which is in one of the reply briefs, obviously in the record also, it's our count number 2, and they're all listed on one page in one verdict, Your Honors. We've got plaintiff's federal policy and practice claim, and we've got, boom, number one is the, you know, picking up and reviewing the medical requests. Cook County, yes, and then understaffing. Cook County and the sheriff, yes, yes, and then the video monitors, yes. And by the way, they found against us and for the sheriff on falsifying daily tier logs. So to get back to your question, we've got it all together. Basically, we're saying, hey, they violated his federal civil rights by these different policies, and the jury said all these three policies were part of it. So I think clearly if one of these policies was to fail on appeal, it wouldn't make any difference because we've got a joint – we've got the sheriff and the county are joint tortfeasors. We've got them here all together on one page, one verdict form. We've got a finding by the jury.
Mr. Alexander, who are the principal actors for the county?
The principal actors for the county?
Yeah, I mean, they're joint, accepting your paradigm of you know, that they're both.
Well, Your Honor, I would posit that it's very much like the Owen analysis where you have a group of anonymous, essentially, government actors. Let's see here. See, we've got... In the Owen case, they talk about when it is the local government itself that is responsible for the constitutional deprivation, not an individual actor. I mean, the number of actors here responsible for these systemic failures that caused the death of Norman Smith are so many.
You know, aren't they generally housed in the sheriff's bubble? I mean, we're talking about individuals that could be perhaps identified.
Well, what we did, Your Honors, is we attempted to find all of the officers liable that were ignoring these requests during the week. And the jury was very discriminating. What they did was they only found the officers liable who were working in, like, about the last day, maybe two, when Mr. Smith's symptoms were, you know, obviously...
Yeah, but that's at the end of the point. I mean, I think what maybe we're trying to get at is... What is it that the county did wrong? I mean, if one of the things the county itself was doing wrong was not funding all of these systems as much, then I guess there's some budget office in the county that was responsible.
Yeah, is there some criminal justice policy coordinator in the county that in some way would impact the sheriff's day-to-day performance of his duties?
Well, what we learned, I hope I'm answering the question. What we learned in the course of discovery is that, you know, the sheriff can make his request to the county for funding and for the people he needs. But of course, the county funds CIRMAC separately. CIRMAC, you know, is not part of the sheriff. So all the CIRMAC stuff comes in through the county. The county's responsible for repairing the video monitors. So that's all strictly county. But the sheriff, you know, makes his request to the county. And what we see is that the budgets, I believe, they were all part of the summary judgment pleadings. I believe they're in the record. And besides, I think they're public documents. In 2004, the sheriff did not request a single additional sheriff deputy for the jail. In fact, what they tell us in one of the reply briefs is that the county didn't provide, even though the sheriffs did their own study showing they needed 700 more sheriffs minimum, the county, they went down two officers from 2003 to 2004 is what they say in their, what the county says in their reply brief at page 5. So they went actually down two officers when the sheriff's own study said we have to have a minimum of 700 more. So, I mean, one thing we said in the pleadings after the case is that there's a lot of blame to go around here. There's so much blame here, and it's very much like Owen, where you've got all of these actors taking steps that they know are going to cause problems for people who are incarcerated.
But even if we believe that the evidence supports that theory that there's a lot of blame to go around, we still have to make sure the right people are brought in. All right. So, and
absolutely,
when we look, because I want to ask you about the damages and the way they're apportioned, because when you look at the verdict form, against the sheriff of Cook County is $1 million, and against Cook County is $3 million. And when you look at the verdict form, the sheriff was found liable on one claim. And so one might say that's why the sheriff has $1 million and that's why the county has $3 million. I'm concerned about whether we should remand the case for a new trial on damages, given that the jury split the damages among the defendants on the failure to provide medical care. And when you look at the rationale that Judge Castile used in terms of knocking off the individual verdicts against the individuals. You know, should he have eliminated that additional $1 million? Well, should it have been $3 million or $4 million? What? Give me your thoughts on that.
Clearly not, Your Honor. What we've got here is the jury determined damages. There's no question the jury came up with the damages number. It was $4,450,000. The jury came up with the damages, and we know that these are joint tortfeasors. So under the law, we know that each defendant is jointly and severally liable for the amount of damages. So it wouldn't make, respectfully, in my opinion, Your Honor, it wouldn't make any sense to remand for damages when the jury came up with the damages number. Now, to further address your point, Your Honor, it is true that the jury apportioned, tried to apportion the $4 million between Cook County and the sheriff, and they probably shouldn't have done that. But, you know, the case law is very clear that you have to strive, we have to strive to make sense out of these verdicts. We can't strive to say, oh, well, they did this or they did that, and it doesn't make any sense, and we got a remand. That collides with the Seventh Amendment.
The theory under which Judge Castile reduced and knocked out the additional individual verdicts was saying that, you know, they were joint tortfeasors. So, you know, he knocked out that additional money, but he did knock out the million against.
Right. Well, he didn't knock out all the individuals. He kept one of the 150,000. And certainly we don't agree that that was correct, that he did that, but we didn't appeal that issue. But we don't agree with what he did. The verdict should have been accumulated. They were accumulated except for the remitter. And the jury determined what the damages were. And then
you say should make sense of it. Do you think the average juror then just looked to the deeper pocket of the county because there were these issues of funding?
No, not at all, Your Honor. You know, this is kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. The plaintiff supplied the instruction that they can't duplicate damages in these counts. And if you look at the closing argument by the plaintiff, it was very reserved, very subdued, and we specifically told the jury, hey, you can't double count on these counts. So you have to allocate them. You have to allocate the damages. Clearly, that's what the jury did. They followed the instructions. They followed what we asked them to do in the argument.
Yeah, in the body of evidence, wouldn't you, just standing back, say there were more actors that are identified in the sheriff's sphere than there were in the county sphere?
I would agree with that, sir, because for one thing, the records are so bad at CERMAC, you know, we don't even know, for the 29th, we don't even know who visited the tier. It's ridiculous. You can't tell, you know, and then you depose these people and everybody's, I never knew him, I never saw him, I don't know anything. That's what everyone says. So it's not like we could have identified particular people who, you know, the requests were made to. I don't know if that answers the question. I'm not trying to dodge the question. I'm not always sure I understand it. But in any event, let's see. So what we're saying is under Owen, you know, the jury determined the damages. They were very diligent about it. This is not a runaway jury, Your Honors. If you look at this verdict form, they only found three. They found five sheriff's officers not liable. Three of our four policy claims we won on, but not one of them. On the wrongful death, they found 3 out of 8 liable. On a survival claim, 3 out of 8. And then they found against us completely on the intentional infliction of emotional distress. This is not a runaway jury here. These people took a lot of time and thought and put a lot of time and thought in this. They determined what the damages were. And then they attempted to do what the instructions said to do, which is you got to allocate them between these counts. And that's what they did. They were probably thinking, well, who's most at fault here? We're going to try to do it that way. But the point is, they didn't. The instructions told them not to double count. And according to the law, we have to assume that they follow those instructions. If there's... I'm here for further questions, if the court has any more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ellinger.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ellinger? Mr. Creighton, your time had expired, but I'll give you an additional minute.
Just some of the things, some of the points that came out during the counsel's examination. In regards to Owens is a direct action case where there wasn't, they didn't give the police officer, the county or the village in that case, the city didn't give a police officer a discharge, the police chief a discharge hearing. So there was action by the government agency itself. Not this is a different kind of case where you have individual actors. In regards to the day before Mr. Smith died, all of those CMTs were identified. They were all deposed, and they were all dismissed out of this case. And in regards, just very quickly on the jury verdict, the jury was also instructed to treat the corporate defendants equally as the individual defendants, which is obviously when they wrote in the county and the sheriff with no space provided for that, they weren't treated equally, and they did go to the deep pocket.
Isn't it equally possible, though, that the jury thought that the failure to have proper policies was the more culpable mm-hmm. in these officers, while deliberately indifferent, really were not as responsible for what happened?
And then
it
we're,
seems to me we're supposed to take the record in the light most favorable to the jury's sure. verdict once it's come up with a verdict.
Then we're back to the Moy issue, and that is...
Right. No, I'm just saying, I don't think that... it seems to me there's a different inference which is not inconsistent with fair treatment of the county that might lead to the larger verdicts against the county.
When you look at the issue of causation here, too, if the individual actors are guilty, individual three officers were deliberately indifferent, then it wasn't an issue of understaffing. It was an issue that they ignored. If that's the case, it was an issue they ignored.
I understand you've made that argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graydon. Mr. Gallagher.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. Daniel Gallagher on behalf of Officer Facundo, Officer Toomey, Officer Sanchez, and the Sheriff of Cook County. The appellee's brief omits a statement of facts. She therefore assents to the facts set forth in the appellant's brief.
I don't think so, in that the appellant's brief does reiterate the standard of review, which is that we're to take the facts in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict.
I would agree that the court does not have to assent to our view, but I believe that since they did not issue or present a statement of facts, the other side has assented to that. There is no evidence in this record that the plaintiff exercised diligence in seeking to have Matthias produced in court. There is no subpoena filed with this court. There is no served subpoena in the record. The rule to show cause was issued. There's an order. It's just a minute order that it was issued.
But the district court refers to the subpoenas. Are you saying that in Judge Castillo's order we should disregard that statement?
I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is, Judge, I don't think that there's a record where there were actual subpoenas brought into the court. There were representations of counsel.
Why does Judge Castillo think there were then?
Because there were representations of counsel.
Was there a request made for the subpoena to be filed by the defendants? You had some concerns that whether or not the subpoena existed or had been served, was there a request made?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor, there was not.
And this rule to show cause, was there any evidence presented in court other than the oral representation that it had been filed? In other words, had he signed it? And was there a request for that made?
No. There was an oral request for a rule to show cause, which the judge entered in as a minute order. There was no rule issued that I'm aware of. There was no issue that was filed that was served, and it was there was no warrant lodged with the court or sought. What happened actually, I have the actual pages of this the record, but in the transcript, at page 1171 of the transcript, the court asks me if in fact is it our position he says, if I'll tell you this, if Mr. Matthias is not here at 12:30, I'm going to issue an arrest warrant for him. This is on December the 5th. Mm-hmm. Now, he said, because I've given him all morning to appear and he's not here. I take it as your position, if he's not here after we've gone through, you want his deposition read. The plaintiff's lawyer said, yes, we do. And he says, and do the defendants oppose that? And I say, yes, sir, we do. Then he asked me what my basis is. I said the basis is that they've gone forward, they've introduced evidence, and they've made comments about this man's testimony, and he says he was served with two subpoenas, or they say he was served with two subpoenas, and they've never requested a warrant. So later on, the judge says, do you think he's available, Mr. Gallagher? And I say, yes, I think he's available. The judge says, I reject that 100%. His deposition will be read. This is what the judge says. His deposition will be read if he's not arrested by the marshals and brought here. If he's not arrested by the marshals, which infers that he's going to issue a warrant now for the man's arrest. But later on, in the same day, he says, because of counsel's argument that Mr. Matthias is, they've talked to him, he's going to appear, at page 1259 of the record, he says, as I understand it with regard to Carl Matthias, if that's how you pronounce it, the arrest warrant has not issued because he has communicated that he will appear here Friday morning and testify. So he was dissuaded from issuing an arrest warrant by counsel. That they kept telling him, you know, Judge, don't issue the arrest warrant. Don't. He'll be here. He says he's here. He's going to come here. And he's the last witness of the trial. And if you take a look at the transcript, he's the longest witness in the trial. He testifies longer than any of the other people who were brought in live. And his testimony is the seminal testimony for this case because he says, I was there from day one. I was there from April 24th till the moment this, and I called for the guard, for the correctional officer on April 30th when the man was on the floor.
And I, as I understand it, on the 7th, you didn't request the warrant.
Excuse me?
Did you request Judge Castile to issue a warrant on the 7th?
On the 7th?
When he didn't show?
No, we did not request the warrant when he didn't show because what had happened was, after the judge said on the 5th, we didn't have trial on the 6th. We were off the 6th. The judge had to, I think he had some other business that he had to take care of. So he said, my suggestion to you is to assign somebody from each team to take a look at his deposition in case he doesn't appear. So that was done. That's what we did on the 6th. It took us all day. We went through there. Then on the 7th, in the morning, the judge just went right into the, put on your first witness, plaintiff, and then when, you know, is Matthias here afterwards? No. Fine. Here are my rulings. Put his deposition on. There was no opportunity at that point to say, well, wait a minute, hold on, let's stop the trial. We want to have a warrant issued. A warrant should have been issued on the 5th. They were in this contact with this man constantly. They said he went to one of your honors asked if they knew where he was. Well, where was he? You know, at one point it was represented that he was actually at 13th in Michigan, that he had a court date of his own at 13th in Michigan, and their investigator went and talked to him. So they knew where this man was. They were in constant contact. They had a cell phone for him. They knew where he lived. They knew where his girlfriend lived, and they contacted him. And they kept saying to the judge over and over again, Judge, don't do anything. He's going to come in.
And so what was the testimony after that deposition was read? The deposition was read on the 7th. What was left in the trial in terms of evidence to be presented?
I believe that may have been their last witness or close to their last witness. There may have been one more. I'm not sure. But I think that was basically the end of it, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Keller.
Thank you
to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.